The Oxford Sparks Podcast, Episode 13, Senses, Part 2.
I am researching the use of motion sensors during training for surgery. We know that as you get better at performing surgery, you make fewer and more efficient movements, as well as having a better understanding of the problems related to the surgery and better at making decisions. But the bit that most people recognise as being surgical is, you know, being a good pair of hands. And we can measure that. So my name is Patrick. I'm a DPhil student doing some research into simulation at the Nuffield Department of Orthopaedics, Rheumatology and Musculoskeletal Sciences.
But how do you measure people's movements in the simulator?
We've got motion sensors that attach to the surgeon's arms, and they have little accelerometers in, like you have in your iPhone. And what they do is send information back to a computer, which essentially does a bit of clever processing and can count the number of hand movements you make, how far you're moving, the dominance, or sort of the amount that you use one hand more than another. And for different procedures, we're planning to show, because it's still early days yet, that these different features for different procedures are different as you get more experienced. We're hoping that you'll be able to show that a given trainee, somebody who's finished medical school but is still not a consultant, over time can observe their own progress and see how they're improving. Equally, they could see bits where they're not as good, and it provides a better focus for them to target their practice. And that brings in the second part of my research, which involves simulators, which are essentially rubber or virtual reality models that allow you to practice particular skills, for example, using a knife or suturing, or even more generic skills. We've got a little maze that you can push a ball around just to get your hand-eye coordination in. And these are all different skills that you piece together. So instead of just practicing the same thing again and again, it's something called deliberate practice, which you may have heard of from people like Malcolm Gladwell, who talks about the 10,000 hour rule. It's not quite that simple, but targeting what you're doing rather than just doing it again and again makes you better quicker.
Which surgeries have they decided to simulate?
The main focus is orthopaedic surgery, which is bones and joints. And within that, we do a form of keyhole surgery called arthroscopic surgery, which means look inside a joint. And you may recognize it from those little cameras that sort of look around, and you've got a little probe or some jaws or a little burr that's flying around. And it's actually really hard to do because it's not just a camera. It's a camera on the end of a stick, and it's looking out to the side. So we have a problem called triangulation, which is basically working out where two things are in the distance. And it's really hard to get your head around when somebody's basically put a 30 degree angle on it. We also use a 70 degree scope, which means you're sort of almost looking over your shoulder, and it's very disorienting the first time you use it. And getting to grips with which way you're actually looking with one hand and then the instrument you're using the other is far more effective in a rubber model than doing it in a person for the first time. So you're literally learning the ropes. You're learning which way's forward, up and down, and practicing all the different use of instruments within this arthroscopic or keyhole surgery. And with that, you get the sort of the early difficulties out of the way before you work on real people. And the arthroscopic surgery we primarily simulate is shoulder, knee, and hip surgery. So you can do arthroscopic surgery in the wrist and the ankle as well.
Why did they choose these three surgeries?
So the three we've chosen are because they're the most common uses for arthroscopic surgery. And they're relatively large joints, actually. The knee, if you ask a wrist arthroscopy specialist, will say you could park a bus in a knee. But in reality, the reason they're chosen is because they were the first ones to be used. The original arthroscopes from however many years ago, probably the 80s now, were large, and the knee you can get in quite easily through the front. Whereas now we've got far finer arthroscopes and you can get into, for example, the wrist. So it's as much a heritage thing in the fact that that's what we do surgery on, that's why we simulate them. The opportunities as our arthroscopes get better will mean that we can do other joints as well. But it's all applicable to all types of keyhole surgery because, as I was saying, we do these generic skills, for example, pushing a ball around a maze. That would apply to, for example, laparoscopic surgery, which means look inside the abdomen, colonoscopy, which is a camera up the bottom to have a look for example, little bits of cancer, or thoracic surgery, which is looking inside the chest wall at the lung, which is a sort of a developing technique that people are using to treat lung cancers that weren't previously thought to be treatable by taking out those cancers that have spread from somewhere else or that were previously too difficult to operate.
Keyhole surgery offers unique challenges to the surgeon operating.
Because you're sticking the tool through basically a small portal in the person, when you move your hand left, it pivots around that point, so your instrument moves to the right. And if you move it up, it moves down, which is incredibly disorienting. If you superimpose that for the fact that you're not looking at it straight, you're looking at it at an angle, it takes a long time to get used to that. So you're using that sort of hand-eye coordination, so the feel and vision, combining those two senses to create a new environment, and that's what we're trying to practice and simulate. On top of that, these instruments, you don't get an awful lot of feedback. They're very fine, and the tissues they're dealing with can be quite delicate. So it's getting that feel for, you know, what's normal tissue, what's weak, how hard you have to press, because they're so delicate and expensive, you don't want to be ruining too many of these instruments. And equally, you're doing something that's quite fine within the human body. And if you push too far, you can have complications. For example, you could scuff bits of the joint that you didn't want to scuff. So it's getting used to handling your senses in a slightly different way and getting used to being a little bit finer, a little bit used to very difficult procedures outside of a human before you have a go for real life.
Do the trainees receive any feedback during the simulation?
Our earliest simulators were, for example, cadaveric or on dead bodies, and that's essentially normal surgery, and so you get the absolute correct feel. Then we moved on to things like rubber models, and the feel that you develop from that is going to be dependent on the materials you use. And we've worked really hard on getting accurate models for bone and accurate models for cartilage and other tissues. Bone's a really interesting tissue because it's got a hard outside and then it's got a nice spongy inside. So you really know if you're pressing and you're pressing too hard, you'll get through the hard bit and suddenly you'll lurch forward, which is really bad news in surgery. You don't want to be lurching anywhere. So we are teaching people to get used to that give just before and using the pressure in their hands to basically ease off before they have that final give. Equally, we've got this virtual reality now, and back when it was originally developed, it was very basic. The pictures were pretty rubbish, to be honest. And you were moving sticks in space, and it had no feel. Whereas now, we have these little haptic sensors, and what they do is, as you move the sensor through space, the computer program works out what it should be touching and applies a tiny little motor pushing back. So it gives you the realism of as you're moving sensor, which isn't touching bone, but it will push back against you as if you're touching about the hardness of bone. Equally, if you're pressing cartilage or something like that, it'll push back at about the right sort of pressure, so you get a feel on the simulator what it's like in real life, and that helps you learn faster because it's not just about having a simulator for practice. You've got to accept it. It's got to feel real, because otherwise it's a silly game. And it's not.
How have the trainees responded to this new training tool?
The training is generally very positive. The background to this is that, very rightly, the public are more interested in how we train as surgeons, and there's more scrutiny over what we do. On top of that, there's been lots of work to make our lives better. For example, not working 120 hours a week, but the corollary to that is that our bosses did far more than what we did. So now our trainees coming through want simulation, they want practice, in the same way our bosses want us to practice before, because it's a different environment. If you take another high intensity, high performance industry, for example, aerospace or Formula One racing, they use simulation all the time, and they're probably shocked that it's not as common in surgery as it should be. But it's becoming more common, and trainees do respond very well to it. It's improving their education, and that's why they like it. On top of that, the actual simulations are getting better, and they respond really well to that. Virtual reality is so much better than when I started medical school a decade ago. I'm sure if you watch Jurassic Park, the new one and the old one, you'll realise that computers are far more powerful. The same applies to the computers we're using for simulating virtual reality. The same applies to the instruments we're using. You can get better instruments that have better feedback. You've got better haptics, which is those motors I was talking about. So the response is positive because they feel it's necessary, and it's positive because we're getting better at it.
Are these simulators also enjoyable to use?
People like playing games, and generally there's this concept of gamification where, for example, you get points for exercising, or you get points for doing something on the internet, and it encourages people to contribute. We know people respond well to competition. We don't know quite yet how that works in surgery, and it's one of the things that we have to be careful about looking into, because ultimately you're training people to be safe, competent surgeons. A little bit of competition so that they want to be the best is good. Too much competition so that they start competing against each other rather than doing what's best for the simulation of the patient. We don't know where that line is. It's a really interesting line of inquiry. And as simulation gets better, we'll be better equipped to look at it. But it's difficult to say right now, unfortunately.
In several of these surgeries, certain key errors have been identified. Focusing on these in the simulator has allowed the trainees to improve quicker.
By focusing somebody's training outside of the operating theatre on those errors, they've been shown to develop faster because they're focusing on these problems that they've identified. And the variety of different tasks that we can simulate, either in sort of a high fidelity simulation such as a fake knee, or a low fidelity sort of a generic task such as moving a ball around a maze, or possibly a sort of an operation type game. You know, it's not surgery, but it's hand-eye coordination. There's more tasks that are available, and each can be tailored to a different problem a trainee might be having in getting to grips with this new technique. Lots of opportunities, and they're all targeted to different problems someone might be having.
The ability to measure the training using the simulator means it's easier to tell how well the trainees are doing.
Operating is quite a big responsibility, and it's very difficult to know if you're doing it right. Lots of operations, you don't know if you've done it correctly until 4 or 5 years down the line. By having some sort of indicator early on that at least you're doing it in the correct fashion, that's a really positive thing as a trainee that you can take away. It's difficult to measure that because all you've got right now is a boss looking at you and saying, well, it looks like how I would have done it. If you can measure it, then you can get a better idea that you're doing it correctly. Equally, there are lots of aspects that you can't see. For example, how much pressure you need to apply to get through a particular tissue, or how tight you need to tie a knot. By practicing on a rubber model, you can be happy in yourself that you know that it's not going to be too tight so that there's no blood getting to that tissue, or can be too loose so it comes apart. Getting that right outside of the patient, I think, is going to be so valuable compared to previous generations which have had to learn on the hoof.
You've been listening to the Oxford Sparks podcast, narrated by me, Brian McInwells. This podcast was produced for the University of Oxford by Steve Pritchard. For more fascinating science, visit www.oxfordsparks.ox.ac.uk.